Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny is dead.
And if confirmed, this would be a further sign of Putin's brutality. Whatever story they tell, let us be clear, Russia is responsible.
Plus, the foreign policies of Donald Trump and Joe Biden.
Biden says he upholds the sacred commitment under NATO's Article 5 that requires members to assist one another in the event of an outside attack. It's a direct clash with Trump, who is again pushing for his brand of America First isolationism.
And later, a look at conspiracy theories, where they come from, and how they spread. Today is Friday, February 16th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Prison officials in Russia say opposition leader Alexei Navalny has died.
Заявление в СИН, которое пришло незадолго до нашего выпуска, скончался Алексей Навальный, как сообщили в управлении.
Russian media quoted officials of the Federal Prison Service as saying Navalny, a fierce opponent of President Vladimir Putin, died Friday in a central Russian penal colony after falling ill during a walk. They say medical staff had been called, but were unable to resuscitate him. Worldwide reaction to Navalny's death was swift. Here's U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris.
We've all just received reports that Alexei Navalny has died in Russia. This is, of course, terrible news, which we are working to confirm. My prayers are with his family, including his wife, Yulia, who is with us today. And if confirmed, this would be a further sign of Putin's brutality. Whatever story they tell, let us be clear, Russia is responsible. And we will have more to say on this later.
That's Vice President Kamala Harris. President Joe Biden is scheduled to speak about Navalny later today. Navalny was allegedly poisoned by Russian authorities in 2020. Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, addressed questions that Navalny was murdered.
We don't have any information now. That's the reason why it is important to have all facts established and why Russia has some very serious questions to answer. What we have seen is that Russia has become a more and more authoritarian power, that they have used oppression against the opposition for many years, and of course he was in jail, he was a prisoner, and that makes it extremely important that Russia now answer all the questions that will be asked about the cause of the death.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was in Germany meeting with European allies. He is blunt, accusing Putin of being responsible for Navalny's death.
We have just learned, as the Chancellor has just said, that Alexei Navalny has died in a Russian prison. Obviously, he was killed by Putin, like thousands of others who have been tormented, tortured because of this one person. Putin doesn't care who dies, as long as he retains his position. And that is why he must not keep anything. Putin must lose everything. He must not retain anything and must be held accountable for what he has done.
Putin все повинен програти. Все повинен втратити і відповідати за скоєне.
Officials say an investigation has been launched to determine the cause of the opposition leader's death. Navalny was serving a 19-year sentence on charges of extremism. For more information and some context, I'm joined by the VOA Russian Service's Misha Komodovsky.
Alexei Navalny had been a vocal critic of the Russian government, of President Vladimir Putin and his administration in particular. So he had opposed what he saw as corruption and authoritarianism within the Russian political system. So basically, he was called the number one rival of President Vladimir Putin.
There's speculation that Navalny was assassinated, that his death wasn't natural. Do you have any evidence of this? Have your sources told you anything that we haven't heard yet?
Well, it's too early now to jump to consequences. But Lebednangi City Hospital, Lebednangi is the city where the prison is located. So the city hospital informed Russian state-run media called RIA Novosti that an ambulance team made some efforts to resuscitate Alexei Navalny for almost 30 minutes without any success. And Lyudmila Navalny, Alexei Navalny's mother, reportedly stated to the Russian independent newspaper Novaya Gazeta that she last saw her son in prison on Monday, and she described him as healthy and cheerful. So the question remains, like, what affected his health so promptly that he passed away in such a short term? And I mean, this is something to be answered in the near future. However, Navalny has faced multiple attempts on his life in the past, if we remember this, including a poisoning incident in 2020 where he was exposed to a nerve agent believed to be Novichok. It basically drew widespread international reaction and criticism back then. It resulted in Navalny's urgent airlift to Germany for some medical care.
Navalny had been in prison for a long time. Did he still represent a threat to Putin and the regime?
Even while in prison, Navalny basically remained a significant figure of opposition to Putin's regime, with his supporters continuing to rally around his cause around the world. And his imprisonment did not eliminate his influence entirely, as his movement and ideas persisted.
And we'll leave it there for today. Misha Komodovsky is the White House correspondent for VOA's Russian service. Misha, thanks for your analysis today.
Thank you.
Following up on a story we brought you on Thursday's show, VOA's Anita Powell has more information on a potential space-based weapon being developed by Russia.
All eyes are on the skies after Washington confirmed that Russia is working on technology that the White House says could violate a treaty banning weapons of mass destruction in space. John Kirby is White House National Security Communications Advisor.
I can confirm that it is related to an anti-satellite capability that Russia is developing. I want to be clear about a couple of things right off the bat. First, this is not an active capability that's been deployed. And though Russia's pursuit of this particular capability is troubling, there is no immediate threat to anyone's safety. We are not talking about a weapon that can be used to attack human beings or cause physical destruction here on Earth.
Congress met Thursday for a closed-door briefing on the matter. Representative Mike Turner heads the House Intelligence Committee and is the person who sounded the alarm Wednesday about the threat.
We all came away with a very strong impression that the administration is taking this very seriously and that the administration has a plan in place.
Pentagon officials said the U.S. Space Force is poised to defend. Analysts say the U.S. military is clear-eyed about the dangers above our heads. Todd Harrison is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute who focuses on defense and space policy.
Whereas in the past, space was a secondary priority for all of the other military services, now it is the top priority for someone in the Pentagon, and they really are starting to move forward on this.
Many of our earthly activities, from global positioning systems that govern mass transportation, to military systems, to weather satellites, are controlled from space. Harrison said other countries are aware of this too, and have been developing their own military technology.
We use space for so many different things in the military that an adversary can take space away from us and deny us the ability to use those space systems. They would negate one of our biggest advantages in the U.S. military. So that's why other nations, like Russia and China in particular, have been developing these anti-satellite capabilities for years now.
Kirby, who said Russia may be violating the Outer Space Treaty with this act, said Washington's first move is diplomatic.
We plan to engage directly with the Russians about this, as well as allies and partners.
Arms control experts note that the 1967 treaty doesn't specify consequences, but they say a violation would alarm other major powers. Daryl Kimball is executive director of the Arms Control Association.
This would affect the global economy, the society writ large. So China would be deeply concerned. India would be extremely concerned. Countries that Russia has better relationships with than they do with us. So I think there would be a stinging rebuke. That might be enough to encourage Russia to back down.
So what now? Watch this space. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump Thursday revisited his remarks that if re-elected, he would not defend NATO members who don't meet defense spending targets. More evidence of how two American presidents and their constituents are divided over America's role in the world. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has this report.
2 years after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, a statement that shocked NATO allies from former president and likely Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump.
And one of the presidents of a big country stood up and said, "Well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us?" I said, "You didn't pay? You're delinquent?" He said, "Yes, let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want."
Can you imagine a former president of the United States saying that?
President Joe Biden, who has made strengthening coalitions against adversaries the central tenet of his foreign policy, slammed his predecessor's transactional approach.
No other president in our history has ever bowed down to a Russian dictator. Well, let me say this as clearly as I can. I never will. For God's sake, it's dumb, it's shameful, it's dangerous, it's un-American.
Biden says he upholds the sacred commitment under NATO's Article 5 that requires members to assist one another in the event of an outside attack. It's a direct clash with Trump, who is again pushing for his brand of America First isolationism. Trump's calls have caused anxiety among allies. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
This year, I expect 18 allies to spend 2% of the GDP on defense. That is another record number, and a six-fold increase from 2014, when only three allies met the target.
Trump campaign senior advisor Jason Miller told VOA in a statement that Trump got our allies to increase their NATO spending by demanding they pay up. Another Trump ally, retired Army Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, suggested a tiered alliance in which members that fail to meet the 2% target on defense would not be covered by Article 5 protections. Others say the signals from Trump and his allies have gone beyond isolationism and contradict the essence of deterrence. Foreign policy is not traditionally a key issue in U.S. elections. With Trump's NATO bashing, however, the broader issue of America's role in the world is set to become another divide among voters. Clifford Young, president of public affairs at Ipsos, via Zoom.
It's highly politicized. It's being used by Trump to gin up his base. But there is an underlying understanding among Americans that the alliance itself is important.
Just 50% of Republicans believe the U.S. benefits from transatlantic alliances, compared with 80% of Democrats and 63% of independents, according to an October poll by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News at the White House.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A look at conspiracy theories coming up soon. Now, as we've said earlier, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was in Germany meeting with allies at the Munich Security Conference. For more, I'm joined by VOA's Kyiv correspondent, Anna Chernikova.
The main aim of this visit is to discuss future defense and security cooperation with Germany. And according to the information from President's office that was already posted and confirmed, that Ukraine and Germany signed a certain agreement, and this agreement is for 10 years, and it will be an agreement about cooperation in the defense area. Germany will support Ukraine financially and with military aid as well. And President Zelensky is also planning to have similar discussions and negotiations in France.
Now, Anna, while Zelensky is discussing the war in France and in Germany, the war rages on in Ukraine. A bad night in Avdiivka. Can you tell us the latest from there? What happened?
They reported, again, we cannot confirm this independently, but Ukrainian forces reported that over the night, Russian forces used phosphorus bombs to attack Ukrainian positions. Just a couple of hours ago, we got confirmation that Ukrainian forces will be leaving their positions in Avdiivka in order to save life of personnel and in order to get better prepared defense positions in that area.
And we're going to leave it there for today, Anna, but you'll be back on the show in just a moment with your story about the Reckoning Project, a group in Kyiv that trains journalists. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
And it's always a great day here at VOA when we get to have two reports from Anna. Here's a story she filed for our Press Freedom Desk about the Reckoning Project. That's a group in Kyiv that seeks to train journalists to work with war crimes investigators.
The Reckoning Project aims to be a game changer in the world of human rights and investigative journalism. Co-founded by Janine DiGiovanni, a human rights reporter and investigator in conflict zones, the project fights for justice and accountability in times of war, in the court of public opinion and the courts of law.
I've always worked in conflict zones, war zones, or the aftermath of war, and I've always taken testimonies of survivors. Someone has to keep a record of that. I think all wars and all places where people suffer should be treated equally.
The Reckoning Project combines advocacy and journalism, training reporters and researchers to record, collect, and conserve witness statements and testimonies so that they can be used in legal cases. That means, among other things, that reporters must ask non-leading questions and not coach witnesses they speak with on how to answer. The journalists are not affiliated with any court system and receive support from foundations and non-profits. The interviews sometimes feature in news reports, but DiGiovanni says there is a bigger purpose.
In the short term, working with prosecutors, working with advocacy, putting pressure on the UN or governments in the long term to keep a lasting memorial of what happened.
2 years into Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the project is laying the groundwork for future war crimes trials. Natalia Gumenyuk leads a Kyiv-based team focused on talking with survivors and witnesses to war crimes.
So everybody to whom we talk potentially are eligible to speak at court. In the cooperation with international analysts and lawyers, we developed this methodology to where what they say is not just the journalistic material, but also can be used as evidence for the prosecutors, for the law enforcement in Ukraine and abroad.
An important task is to prove that certain war crimes are not an aberration, but part of a pattern perpetrated by the Russian army. Moscow denies carrying out atrocities, even as the UN documents Russian tactics causing over 10,000 civilian deaths, its abduction of hundreds, possibly thousands of children, and use of rape as a weapon.
We see that the same commanders are still, you know, shelling the rockets indiscriminately into the civilian infrastructure, into the train station, houses, shopping malls, and things like that. And they act the same way. They torture the people. They electrocute them the very same way in Berdyansk and in Kherson, in Kakhovka, and as it was in Izum.
With the International Criminal Court issuing arrest warrants for Russian President Vladimir Putin and the U.S. unsealing war crimes charges against Russian military personnel, the work of the Reckoning Project and others is likely to play an important role in future hearings. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Taylor Swift's romance, along with the Chiefs' Super Bowl victory, was concocted for political gain. High-ranking Democrats are abusing children in the basement of a Washington, D.C. pizza restaurant. The COVID-19 vaccine is actually a system for government mind control. Conspiracy theories like these may sound far-fetched or even crazy, but they can be dangerous and damaging to democracy. Ozzy Pebara writes for The Washington Post.
It can sometimes be difficult to identify like a patient zero or a specific origin point for some of these things. But in this case, like many things in 2024. It started on the internet with some skepticism about the agency and the political machinations of a young, successful singer named Taylor Swift and her fights over control of her music catalog. And some person who has a large following on X, formerly known as Twitter, tried to connect some dots between Taylor Swift's legal fight to get control over her music catalog and a Democratic donor who may or may not have been involved in that business transaction. And this person on the internet said, you know what? I think that these two things are somehow related.
Well, I'd like to kind of steer this away from the he said, she said about Taylor Swift and really focus on the generalities of conspiracy theories.
Sure.
No one is saying these people are stupid, uneducated, mentally ill, and they're not. But what's the mechanism that would make somebody, a normal person watching television and go, you know what? I do believe.
There is an argument that if there was a breakdown in the sort of social trust, if, just to use a hypothetical example, if, you know, if the buses and trains don't run on time, and if people think they're not being listened to when they complain to their local elected officials about garbage pickup, or if they vote for someone and they lose an election, there are all these things in life that can build distrust about the world around them. And if someone's needs aren't met, if they pay for insurance, like for health insurance, and that health insurance doesn't end up paying their medical bills when they need it, there's all sorts of things that people can feel like the world around them isn't working the way it should and that there's something wrong. It can be a vague sense or it can be a specific sense. And if there is, you know, diminishing trusted news outlets in places that are economically depressed, you know, that could lead people to look to alternate sources of information that are less credible than others. There's all sorts of ways that well-meaning, well-intentioned people who may be working one or two jobs or not working enough and are struggling economically or struggling in all sorts of other ways. There's plenty of reasons of how someone could get primed to be suspicious of facts in front of them or distrustful of people who are supposed to be relied upon or distrustful of institutions and just feel like something isn't working for them. And there's an explanation needed as to why things aren't working out. And this is a place where conspiracies offer the feeling of information without any of the facts oftentimes.
I think all too often the media treats conspiracy theories like we've been talking about as a joke, right? And the people who believe them right. as objects of ridicule when they really should be addressing those root grievances as to what they're looking for in these beliefs, yes?
Yeah, it can oftentimes be seen as a symptom of something else being wrong. You know, how does someone get into a position where they're reading something that may look outlandish to you and me, but for some reason they believe it as credible? What happened to lead this person to that moment? That is something that I think sociologists and lawmakers and public health officials and a lot of others look at it with real seriousness. You know, there are people who talk about a loneliness epidemic where people are spending less time face to face, where, you know, demographic changes where people are deciding to live and rural parts of the United States are being economically hit in ways that urban areas are feeling less so, and people are being sorted politically. There's all sorts of things that in 2024, you know, you may find less social cohesion than you did 15 or 20 years ago. And that all can create a stew for certain people to start believing in things that they may not have otherwise.
Ozzy Pabara is a writer for The Washington Post. You can read his article on conspiracy theories and Taylor Swift at WashingtonPost.com. Ozzy, thanks so much for being with us today. Thanks for your analysis on this.
Thanks for having me.
And that's going to do it for today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.